Thank you for joining me today.
You're welcome.
Your career started with a PhD in physics from the University of St. Andrews, and you went on to work as a lecturer and then as a manager for nanotechnology companies.
Yes, yes.
Now you hold two main roles. You are a professor of medical nanotechnology at the University of the Highlands and Islands, and you are the managing director of two nanotechnology companies, and I'm not sure how to pronounce them, Nicolite, is that right?
Nicolite
and NicaWorks.
NicaWorks. People often ask me where Nika comes from. I didn't want to set up companies that are called Nanotechnology Inc. or something like that. So I thought, well, what are my two favourite things? Nanotechnology, and I used to travel to Japan a lot. I love my food. My favourite Japanese food is squid, and Japanese for squid is Ika. So it's nano squid, Japanese, Nika. When I go to Japan, they love it.
So the squid isn't part of the research, it's just something that happens.
In fact, squid is a huge subject in the area of nanotechnology.
Okay.
If you go swimming with squid, which I've done, they swim in shoals, I don't know if that's the collective name. They've got these molecules on the surface of their skin that allow them to change colour at will, and that's real nanotechnology. It's incredible, they communicate with their colour. So if they are alerted, it's almost like a TV screen. They all change colour at the same time. It's just incredible how it happens. They're a huge area of research for natural nanotechnology as well. So it all marries up together.
Maybe just briefly, and I know you could probably talk for hours about this, what is medical nanotechnology?
You have to step back and say, first of all, what is nanotechnology? And then how might that apply to the medical arena? The definition in the European Union is essentially if you work with a structure or a nanoparticle that is less than 100 nanometers in size, that is classed as a nanoscale material. What is nanotechnology? Well, the way I think about it is technology now has enabled us to work with 1, 2, 3 dimensional structures down at that scale and engineer them. And the fantastic thing about nanotechnology is you can scale things down from centimetres to microns and engineer things. But when you get to the nanoscale, then things start behaving unusually, unclassically. So when you get to the nanoscale, there are quantum effects that come in. But the amazing thing is they're out there in everyday use. So you go into a TV showroom nowadays, and there are displays which are QLED displays, and these displays work by having organic light-emitting diodes, and then they have a phosphor in the diode to change what the wavelength of the light, essentially, and in that phosphor they incorporate something called a quantum dot, which is tens of nanometers in size, which translates the light to another wavelength, but extremely efficiently, using a quantum effect at the nanoscale. That's the stuff is out there. So that's nanotechnology. There's a gentleman called Alexander von Humboldt who inspired Darwin to go on his voyages. And von Humboldt went around the world discovering nature, and he was one of the first people that said, actually, the whole world is a living synergetic thing. And he took inspiration from nature. And I like to follow on from that by saying, well, if you want to know what nanotechnology is, look at anything in the room, because anything in the room, the fibres in my jumper, the leaves out there, the grass, all operate at the nanoscale. The nanoscale tends to be about the scale of molecules. Nanotechnology is in everything. It's in physics, chemistry, life, nature. My background's physics. I've done a lot of work recently in chemistry. I've always had a fascination for the medical area. How can nanotechnology relate to medicine? Well, a great deal of medicine is, you know, unfortunately we fall ill and we have to do things to people. And where we do things to people, that means there's an interface between the consultant, the surgeon, and the person. That means that there's an interaction, whether it's an implant or a drug, that interacts with the body. That all happens at the nanoscale. By engineering how we interact with people, how we apply things to people, nanotechnology can come in there. A practical example of that is that I've been working on a nanostructured surface for about the past 15 years, looking at how infections work, how bacteria work. In hospitals now, there's a huge problem with people picking up infection in hospital. They're called HAIs, hospital acquired infections. In North America, it's something like $100 billion a year it costs to treat people who get sick after they enter the hospital. And that happens because in about 99% of the cases, people touch something that's infected, and then you just have to touch your eye or your nose and you become infected. We've got a wooden table in front of us. If I put E. coli on that, which is a bug that can make us sick, it could live or hibernate on the surface for about 2 to 3 months. You can just touch it and pick it up and you'll be sick. That's always fascinated me. I've been working at ways of killing bugs that affect people. There are chemical ways to do it, like bleach. You can wipe something. And people have been looking at silver and copper. You know, you go to a sportswear store and you can get copper socks that are, you know, kill things. So I worked on that for some years. You've got to be careful with silver and copper because they kill bugs by essentially you remove an ion from the metal. The ion goes through the cell wall and damages the DNA. But copper and silver can be toxic. My wife actually is allergic to reasonable levels of copper. So you've got to be careful about that. So for the past 8 years, I've been working with a company where we have developed a method to make nano-structured surfaces. And we've discovered that if we make particular, we take biocompatible metals, oxidize them, so we've got an inert metal oxide coating, and we discovered that if we nanostructure it, it's highly antimicrobial. And then we played around with ion beams so that we can control the nanostructure down to about the scale of 10 nanometers. Not quite atomic, but at the kind of molecular scale. We found that if we got to a particular structure, we increased the efficacy of our surface by 3 orders of magnitude. So this surface now has got, you refer to antimicrobial coatings as having a kill rate, and it's a log scale. Our best coating has got a log 6 kill rate, which means that if I put down 1 million E. coli on this surface, after 2 hours, there will be 0 or 1 left. And that's equivalent to putting bleach on a surface, but the bleach is there all the time and it doesn't wear out, and our coating is harder than stainless steel. So I have interest from all over the world now, and we'll be carrying out more research there. We'll be looking at the efficacy, biocompatibility, any response from the humans. We'll be looking at processing in hospital, working with companies making surgical instruments. One of the reasons I took on the role at Inverness is the last time I was an academic was 92. I left academia in 92 and I thought, right, I'm going off into industry. And I've had academic opportunities over the past few decades, but nothing really came to fruition. But there's a difference in Inverness because it's a small university. It's really a blank canvas, and they invited me there to do what I want to do, and they really understood what I wanted to do. And it's the scale of the operation up there is such that I work with the NHS, I work with Highlands and Islands Enterprise. I'm in a building just now which is next door to the hospital. I can walk into the hospital, go up to the surgeon's office, speak to them. I've given lectures to them. Just before Christmas, they said, come with us for a day, turn up at 8 o'clock, you'll be in the operating theatre all day long. We want to show you how it is in reality. So I spent the whole day, I watched about 8 operations. That was a remarkable day. I saw hip replacements, shoulder operations, fingers, knees, Achilles. But the main reason they had me in was there was a diabetic lady who had fractured an ankle. They had operated on her, put in something called a nail, which goes down the centre of the shin bone, and used that scaffolding to rebuild her ankle with various titanium alloys and threads. A few weeks later, it swelled up and she had an infection in there. So they had to reoperate, take out all the scaffolding, which had done its job by then, and then pack the infected area with antibiotic cement. So during the operation, the surgeon took out this nail and said, this needs an antimicrobial coating. There's a high chance that the bug came in on this nail. If we could have products like this, where we know there's a much less likelihood of having an infection on it, then we will cut down infection rates in hospitals. That's coming from the horse's mouth, and that's absolutely fantastic. But in Inverness, I'm going to be working on antimicrobial coatings, new techniques for putting diamond on implants to reduce friction and wear, new ways of 3D printing, making functional materials. So I'll be building up a nanomaterials applied to healthcare lab, also building up a photonics lab, and which is, there's a lot of really good work here at Edinburgh University on using physics, electronics, engineering, chemistry applied to healthcare. That's one of the reasons I was at the lecture last night. So I'll be building up a photonics lab to utilise light to measure and do active things for healthcare as well. I can't remember what the question was.
That was great. Well, it was kind of an introduction to medical nanotechnology.
Yes.
So I think that really explained it. And at first, when you first started talking about it, I was thinking, oh, these coatings would be useful for surfaces in hospitals to prevent spread of infection. And I'm guessing that is one application, but it sounds like would be for the use of things that are actually put into people.
Yes. And it's about in the future now. No, so I'm looking at what are fairly simple things. You know, the body does a lot of things that are far cleverer. I'm looking at antimicrobials, mechanical coatings, but in the future we'll be looking at putting something into the body. How do we make the body think it's really friendly? How do we make the bone grow on it? Oh, and by the way, why don't we put a nanoscaled pH sensor in there, a strain sensor, something that measures the electrochemistry of a cell? Because biology it's all about electrochemistry. Electrochemistry is all about physics. Physics is all about electrons and energy. I go to this conference, which is full of chemical engineers, and they laugh at me because I say, you know, basically it's all about electrons. We can now, in Colin Campbell at university here, is making optical nanosensors which do such things in the body, and they're beginning to apply that. I'm hoping to work with the guys at Edinburgh and throughout SUPA to collaborate, because if you go back a few decades, then you had your physics department, your chemistry department, your engineering department, and never the twain or the three shall meet. But the future of research is interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary. My lab up in Inverness, I'll be bringing in not just different kinds of research and academia, but I'll be bringing in the companies. So my research is aimed at using physics and chemistry, and I'm learning biochemistry now. I feel like, you know, I'm a first year biochemistry student. I've learned physics. I've learned what I don't know in physics, what I don't know in chemistry. I don't know anything in biochemistry, so that's what I'm aiming to learn now. But I'll be bringing in academic students, postdocs, but also companies. So there's the beginning of some very interesting companies in Inverness. So doing the academic research, but the whole point of doing the research is so that we can apply it to something useful, which at the end of the day can stop someone getting sick or measure someone, prevent them getting sick in the first place. The other aim is remote healthcare. So up in the Highlands and Islands, my office overlooks the helipad. So every day the helicopter's in and out, bringing people from the islands because they need to get something measured or put in. So remote healthcare is a big thing for the future. The other big aim is that we will build up commercial operation there, which will employ people in Inverness. So there's a hub. We've got something called the Inverness campus, which is a 250-acre campus. We built Inverness College, which is a university college for young people, you know, from about 14 up to degree. And only last year the university awarded its first PhD. That's how young the university is. And on that new campus, we're going to build a research hospital with a 40-bed ward, Government Innovation Centre, and a new university building with about half of the building being medical nanotechnology.
So when you refer to the university, you mean the University of the Highlands and Islands?
Yes.
As I understand it, and I have to admit I don't know that much about it, it's kind of a collaboration or a collection. It's not all in one place, I guess is what I mean.
That's right. The university, the Highlands and Islands, I think is about 25, 30 years old. It was started up, you're right, it was a collective of colleges around the Highlands and Islands, which is a huge area with less than 1 million people. So it was set up with the idea of connecting people and enabling people to learn. About 10 years ago, Highlands and Islands Enterprise put together a building by the hospital, which is called the Centre for Health Science. And Ian Megson, who was at Edinburgh University, moved up there about 10 years ago, set up research, healthcare, innovation. He now has an expanded group of about 70 people, over about half in Inverness, half spread throughout the other colleges. Just last year, the university took over the Centre for Health Science, so that's now a core university building in Inverness. And that does, you know, training, dental training, nurse training. The ambition is that we'll build up the level of training, we'll go up the kind of value chain in the qualification scale. So we've got this expanse where we'll build up. So already we've got the college, we've got student accommodation. We have, I think, three government buildings, two of which are pretty much full with startups and SMEs. It's a bit of a pot boiling away with ideas. The great thing there is that you can just sit down with the people that run Highlands and Islands Enterprise, the NHS innovation people, go out to a pub with the surgeons and discuss ideas. If you go to somewhere like Oxford or Cambridge, where I've worked, getting things to happen is difficult because of the huge inertia.
Well, what's really ideal for you is the amount of communication and contact you have with people, like, yes, like you described, going in and watching surgery for a day. And I imagine that's probably never happened in Oxford, that you had that kind of experience.
Yes, that's absolutely true.
If we go back a little bit, so your first degree in physics is from the University of Strathclyde, and so I'm wondering, did you grow up in Glasgow?
Grew up in the area. My mother originally from Aberdeenshire, father from Glasgow. Their first house was in Bishopbriggs, just north of Glasgow, and then they moved out to Lindsay when I was 6 months in 1961. So I grew up there. Up until about the age of 16 or 17, I had absolutely no idea what I wanted to do. I was almost going to go into the Merchant Navy and go to sea, because at school I had a teacher who was in the Merchant Navy who was enthusiastic about engineering and what he did. My physics teacher at school wasn't so good, and my chemistry teacher even worse. I didn't go through the standard application process for university, so sometimes you just got to be lucky. My father had a friend who had a friend at, it was called Glasgow Tech these days, which I think is at Caledonian University.
Maybe, or, I'm not sure.
In Glasgow. So I went in to meet this man. His name was Professor McPherson. I remember his name because he changed my life. And he said, you look at your O grades as they were these days, you know, you should be at university with those grades. Come and see what I do. Took me down the stairs along the corridor, opened a door into his lab, and all I could see were laser beams everywhere. And I said, that's it. That's what I want to do. I don't understand these. How do they work? Then I walked to Strathclyde University, walked up to the professor's administration office, and I said, I want to study here. What do I do? And they let me in. But I wasn't very academic at school. I don't think things clicked with me until first year at university was really tough. I nearly failed it because, you know, I just don't remember things. So when it comes to first year physics, there's a lot of groundwork. You've got to learn the tools to enable you to do things. Towards the end of second year, it was less about learning the ground rules and more about understanding how things happened. And I found that, for me, that was the easy part. And we started getting exams where they'd set us complex problems, but they essentially they were open book. You can have the tools you want, but we can ask you whatever you want. And it was kind of things opened up for me after that, and I never looked back. It was fantastic.
When you were quite young in school, mm-hmm. in sort of the primary and secondary school,
yeah.
you wouldn't say that you had a strong interest in science. That wasn't something that stood out. Or do you remember?
I had an huge interest in how things worked. My mates in primary school, if they had anything that they'd broken at home, they would bring it to me. Bring it, Alistair, he'll fix it. But I also loved art. Even in secondary school, my best grades were in languages and art. My worst grades were in physics and chemistry.
Isn't that interesting?
But physics bumped me because I knew that's how the world works and I don't understand it. Languages and art, I love drawing and painting. That's just came naturally. So I'm completely ambidextrous. I think people, when they figure out how brains work, you know, science and art is hugely interrelated. You know, people say that science isn't artistic, but I think the best science is pure art. I went from primary to secondary, did a broad range, and then I had to decide, hone in subjects, which I think when I was about 14, I dropped art and languages, and I did physics, chemistry, mathematics. And it's funny how it's come out in my children. It's my eldest daughter who's just started university. She's my artistic side. She's a pure artist, not academic. She's studying performing arts and technical creativity. My eldest son is better than me at mathematics. Loves his maths, and he wants to study maths and physics and astrophysics at university. So it's almost like I've split up in these two. Yeah. And then I've got a young son who's, you know, even worse than I was at school. We don't know what he's going to do.
But you know he'll bloom into something.
And he certainly will, yeah.
After your PhD, you worked as a research fellow and lecturer at the University of Glasgow. You went on to work in the Optoelectronic Device Group at Sharp Laboratories, where you became a research group manager. And why did you move away from academia, and how was working in a commercial research and development area different?
I was at Cambridge in the mid to late 1980s. I went to Cambridge really because it's the Cavendish Laboratory. It's world famous. Worked there for a couple of years. It's very good for the CV. I worked in the semiconductor physics group, and every day there'd be one or two Nobel Prize winners. And I knew Neville Mott, who's one of the most famous physicists that ever lived. Soaking up that experience was great. I moved back to Glasgow University because I love Glasgow. A few years earlier, they had a disastrous fire in one of their labs, but they were rebuilding with some nice funding, and I got offered a research fellow position to work, and that was a great move because we did some really fantastic research. But in the late 80s, funding wasn't fantastic. We were doing great work. Our group, we had a world record for purity in a semiconductor. We were world famous, went to conferences all around the world. But my boss in the group came up to me and said, okay, you're on your 2-3 year research contract. After this one, don't think we're going to get another grant.
Yeah.
And there aren't any lectureships going just now, so, you know,
go find something.
Good luck. This is how things happen. You just got to grab opportunities. I had a friend from days at St Andrews doing my PhD, and he went off to work in Japan, NTT, and various people. And he called me up and he said, I've heard that Sharp Corporation are going to build a research lab somewhere in Europe. I'll keep you posted. They decided in Oxford. So when they started to set up their lab, they asked me to come and give a talk. The guys that were beginning to found the laboratory had some ideas about the areas they'd like to set up research in, and it matched exactly with what I was doing at Glasgow and my ambitions. If you get a good job offer, and it was a pay rise, it was working for Sharp. Going out into that commercial world, it gives you another set of experience, how to work within a huge global corporation. I worked my way up, essentially from a junior research in this group, ended up managing the group, so I had about 10-15 people in the labs and various people at universities, so looking after about 20-25 people. So I was there for about 8 years, and I ended up not doing much research because I'd worked my way up to become a manager, so I spent a lot of time travelling back and forth to Japan, which was fun at the start, and then towards the end, you know, probably travelling 3 or 4 times a year, it got a bit hard work, and then another offer came along after that.
In 2000, you co-founded Chameleon. It's a company that manufactured semiconductors and diodes. How did that come about?
We had a telecoms boom in the mid to late 90s, early 2000. Together with ex-colleagues from Sharp who had left and were doing other things, and some colleagues at Glasgow University, we had an idea to build an optical component for telecoms called a semiconductor optical amplifier. It's a device that is a bit like a laser because it amplifies light, but a laser amplifies light and you get a laser beam. An optical amplifier, you take light in the form from a fibre which has a signal on it, so it's all over the place now, fibre to the home. Historically, what you would do to, if you're transmitting that over a distance, after every 25 kilometres, you would take that signal out, measure it, turn it into an electronic signal, amplify it, and then turn it back via an LED or laser back into light, put it back into fibre. It's possible to do it completely in the optical domain without going into electrons. So you basically put light into this device and amplify it and then put it back into the fibre. But the trick is taking all the information in and amplifying it, and the information comes out amplified, but it's the same information. So doing that electro-optically is actually rather challenging. So we had to make our devices and control the geometry at the scale of about 2 or 3 nanometers, you know, so tens of atoms, in order to control the purity of the signal. At that time, telecoms, there was a huge amount of money going around, billions of dollars in potential funding. So when we set up and advertised what we were doing to investors, we had people queuing at the door to invest in us. So we had to be very careful not to take on too much investment. You know, we're talking tens of millions of dollars we took on, because we built a semiconductor fab from nothing. So we would buy in the gases, turn those gases into semiconductors, use lithography, make the devices, use technology to package them, turn them into chips, couple the fibres, put them in packages. I should have brought one with me. Actually, I've got one at home. And so essentially we sold a device that you could just then plug your fibres into and amplify your signal. Initially, our idea was that we would build up networks of these components to act as a signal processor. We ended up selling single units, but there were two problems with the business. One was that we were slightly ahead of the market, and we were funded by venture capital. And the way venture capital operates, it decides what's fashionable to invest in and goes with that. So we were just on the wrong side of the wave of the investment, so we couldn't find further investment. If we had another investment of $1 million or so, it would have seen us through to profit, but nobody would invest in us because the telecoms boom had passed, and that was it. So we had to close the company down. I've been made redundant about 3 or 4 times. It's hugely refreshing to be made redundant.
So when you started this, it sounds like it was a group of you.
There were 7 of us. We co-founded it with 7, and then we got up to about 40 people at one stage. We set up in Glasgow, and we built a manufacturing plant just north of Oxford, which was very exciting. Just the experience of building up a company like that is worth. You invest in something like that, and you know, you always think, oh, you know, maybe I'll make something out of it. When I walked out the door, I had a pair of steel-capped Wellington boots. That's what I got from the company.
When you were working there, I mean, there's a lot involved in starting and managing a business, and it sounds like, I mean, a fairly large-scale project there.
Yes.
Did you have, or did one of your 7 have a background in business or in other areas? Were they all scientists?
All scientists, but a couple of my colleagues had moved into a more entrepreneurial area. For instance, one of my colleagues, he had worked for University Innovation Department. He had already set up a couple of companies. It's about having the right mixture of people there. So this was my first step into doing something like this. My main role in the business was on the technical side, to make sure that we could make what we said we could make. But during that process, I was learning a lot about how such a thing operates, bigger vision of that kind of thing.
Of those 7 people, had you all gone full out? I mean, was anybody working, say, they kept their main job and they would work there 2 days a week, or was everybody fully invested in terms of their time working on that?
We had a couple of academics. If you work in academia, you can come to an arrangement where you can have a form of secondment, because it can benefit the university as well if things go well. There were three of us, myself and a colleague at Sharp and another colleague who basically had to make the decision to say, right, I'm going to resign my role. And it's quite a big step because I was in a very good job. I'd just been paid a big bonus. And I had to say, well, let's go for it. It's exciting. I've always been a bit like that. I hate being in a job where I can look 10 or 20 years down the line and see where I'll be, because that's not... Life is short. I have always liked doing something where I'm not quite sure where it's going, which can be a bit scary for your family, especially your wife.
In 2004, you became a technical director at Mantis Deposition. And how did you find that change? So you had been working at Chameleon, which was a company that you co-founded.
Yeah.
And then you were working at Mantis, where you were working for a company that someone else had founded. So you're working for an organization that already existed.
Yeah.
Was that a challenging transition to make, or did it feel quite natural?
It was a big change. It was quite interesting because after, when Chameleon went down, I had a couple of opportunities. One was actually up in Glasgow, but locally, we live in the countryside in Oxford. A gentleman I'd come across a few times in the past had set up a company the previous year, which was exactly my field of expertise. It was quite attractive to me because it was a family-funded business. Things were done very much on a shoestring. I was the fourth employee of this company. It was a big change because we were making scientific equipment. And when I say making it, literally, it's another experience where you work in a company where you're making a piece of equipment. You know the courier is going to turn up at 3:45. It's got to be shipped out that day. Otherwise, you don't get paid at the end of the month. And there were several months where we didn't get paid because we didn't get the shipment out the door. The guy comes up to pick up the product to ship it, and you're busy finishing off the electrical test on and standing with the foam to pack it. You're giving the courier a quick cup of tea. And in order to make these things work, I had to... we need this piece of metal turned down to this diameter. You just had to get on the lathe or the milling machine and figure out how to do it. That's a fantastic experience because now I do research in nanomaterials by using all this incredible kit to do it. But if you give me a lathe and a bit of metal, I can make it. I can make the kit that makes the nanomaterials. So that was a great experience, that company. That was another experience of industry, but a different area, different scale.
And how long were you there? So that was
started. I was there until 2013. Yes, about 8 or 9 years. And again, this is an interesting experience because I'd been there a few years, and then the owner decided that he wanted to bring in some investment to scale the company up a bit. He decided on using private equity investment, which is different from venture capital. Private equity varies a bit between private equity companies, but what they tend to do is they will invest in a company to increase its value over a specific period of time, and then they'll sell the company. I knew about this, so as soon as I knew we were getting investment in 2010, I said, great. And then I started planning my exit because I knew what was going to happen. What we did at Mantis was I helped get the company up and running by building the kit. And then I worked in this new process, which essentially this took me from semiconductors, which I've been working on all my career. But I get introduced to the world of nanomaterials. And at Mantis, I developed a technique to make nanoparticles by the techniques that I knew. It was a bit of a revelation to me because it took me from semiconductor physics into three-dimensional materials, and it was the kind of opening of the path into nanotechnology. And I realised how exciting these materials could be. So I built up the equipment to make these nanoparticles, and then I started getting projects ongoing with companies around the world to investigate these materials. I went onto the applied side with the company, even though I was the technical director, which was great for me, but if you get investment in a company, when you move towards selling the company, the people that are interested in it will come in and do technical due diligence. They'll look at the company. There will be accountants come in to do the financial due diligence. And at that point, you have to make the company look as valuable as possible. And that comes down to things called profit and loss lines, money in the bank, pipeline, balance. And the way you increase the value of the company is by shutting down anything that doesn't make the company valuable immediately. So anything to do with research just gets completely shut down. And I understood that. So I was made redundant before the company was sold. The gentleman that ran the company was completely sympathetic. He said, I love your research you're doing, but we're selling the company. This is what has to happen. There isn't a job for you here anymore. On the good side, we don't mind if you come back and use our equipment. We'll give you access to all of our intellectual property. We'll give you freedom to operate with all the stuff you've done here. The only thing we ask is that you don't compete directly with us by making things. So I agreed that. And because I'd had several collaborations with companies, the day before I was made redundant, I had to terminate all of the research contracts. I had a purchase order from a big American electronics company, an open purchase order to do whatever research I wanted for them, and I had to phone them up and say, sorry, I'm going to have to tear up your contract. I happened to be doing a lot of work for a company called Johnson Matthey, a big chemical company, so I had to phone them up and say, we can't do research for you anymore, I'm leaving. When I left, I was making material for people that were paying us to do that, but I had to call them and say, we're not doing this work anymore. So immediately I was made redundant. I set up my own company so that I could go back to Mantis and continue the work to supply these people. Hence, that was Nika Works.
So it wasn't considered a competition because it was something that they were no longer doing?
That's right. No competition because Mantis Deposition was making equipment hardware for people to do research. My interest was making material using such equipment, selling the material. Essentially, when I get in touch with Johnson Matthey, who I've been working with for years, I'm allowed to say that I'm now and presently working with Johnson Matthey as a consultant. They were keen for me to continue doing research with them. So through Nika Works, I consult with Johnson Matthey. They have a laboratory just north of Reading, about 250 scientists, so I have a laboratory there where I'm working on materials for Johnson Matthey in lots of exciting areas.
Considering the multiple roles that you now have, so you are managing these two companies, mm-hmm. and you're also a professor, can you describe a good day at work? So if you're having a really good day, what kinds of things are happening?
Yeah, you're right. I have several different roles, probably about four or five roles. In many ways, you have to keep things separate. Especially the work I'm doing at Johnson Matthey is purely for Johnson Matthey. With my contract with Johnson Matthey, I have freedom to operate in certain areas. You have to be careful, and there are boundaries, but there's a way you can work where everything is related, and if you're very open about what you're doing, then the way I operate is good for everyone that I work with. For instance, Johnson Matthey know about my work in Inverness, the work I'm doing there, and they're essentially supportive that it's great what you're doing, and vice versa. The companies I got responsibilities for, Nika Works is essentially my consultancy company, but I also still do coatings for people, except now that I contract out coatings, so I know people that specialise in various coatings, and people come to me and say, we have this product, like I've got a meeting tomorrow with a company who makes surgical instruments. There are new regulations coming out from NICE who are saying that instruments which are being used for adults and children, they have to be identified from each other. So we are looking to put ultra-hard coatings onto surgical instruments which will allow you to identify what class they are. That's an example of a kind of coating that one can do. So Nika Works does the consultancy and also the contract coatings for people. Nika Light evolved because my previous company, Mantis, went into liquidation last year, which is the way things go and the way I saw things going. there are some great people at Mantis Deposition, and I had some ideas in my mind. So we set up a company to continue to develop technology in nanomaterials. We've developed a unique scientific instrument in the world. So my research is in how to make nanoparticles, and Mantis sold equipment that was very expensive, hundreds of thousands, did magical things, but you had to be really clever to make it work. So we've developed this, it looks a bit like the printer behind you. We've developed an instrument where you, if you're working in nanoparticles for sensors, for biological immobilization, you can take your substrate and put it in through a door, close the door, press a button, and you'll get nanoparticles deposited, beautiful nanoparticles. So we're very excited about that. So that, I didn't plan that company, but when my old company went bust, I thought, oh, that's crazy. We were doing great things there. I met up with some of my colleagues in Costa Coffee, and we looked at each other, and I said, I've got an idea. And they said, right, let's... That's another example of, you know, I'm lucky enough that I've got lots of contacts now, because I had to say, right, let's set this up, and we're going to have to raise some money to do this. And it's basically friends, family, contacts, people you know, try and pull enough funding to get the thing off the ground. And we've done that. And we're at an exciting point. We're building our first product, and we're about to run out of money. We'll enter the next phase in the next week or so with that company. Your question was, what's a good day for me? Every day is a good day for me now, because I don't really have a boss anymore. People let me go on with what I want to do. I think the main thing is, if you got on in your career and two things, people trust you, but people learn to trust you because you say you'll do something and you do it. The key thing is not to say you'll do things and then don't do it. Then people trust you. They will invest time, effort, money in you. For instance, yesterday I've got some projects on the go where I need to do some things which are slightly unusual, and people are saying, is it okay to do this? And I can say, I'll get some independent support. I can contact people around the world. So I've received just really letters of support saying, Alistair knows what he's talking about, it, he'll do it, give him the backing. It's just building that kind of trust. That's important. But yes, my day is, I'm with my new role in Inverness. It's a part-time role because of my other work, but everything is interrelated. So I'm up in Inverness from Oxford once every other week. So when I'm up there, I'm focusing mainly on what I'm planning up there. But because everything happens in parallel, I'm always working on everything at the same time. That's the only way I can operate. If I tried to separate things out, I couldn't do it, it wouldn't work. A lot of people say men can't multitask, but it depends on the person. People ask me how I cope with so many roles, and I think it's just that everything's continually, it's like a tumble dryer in my mind, everything's, you know, even talking to you, I'm thinking about, I've got two important meetings tomorrow, and they're in running along in the background, what I'm going to do tomorrow, and the meeting yesterday at Edinburgh, that's given me lots of ideas for what we'll do up in Inverness. So all of these things are just tumbling around. But if I was still at Sharp, that's a completely different mindset, because you're in a big corporation, you have to satisfy the business units to add value to the company. So it's a really structured way you have to work in a corporation, and I don't operate like that anymore, which I really enjoy. I feel much more like a free agent these days. It's almost like I've spent 35, 40 years working the field, and I feel that I've got enough experience now. I never thought I'd be an academic again, but I'm doing it because I think I can do something good, kind of payback. I love doing that kind of thing.
So you don't, and I'm just kind of, I think, summarising what you've already said, you don't spend one day a week working for this company and one day working for that company, but maybe when you get up in the morning, do you kind of organise your thinking about what meeting you're going to have next?
Especially with Johnson Matthey, I consult to them, so when I'm there, I focus on my projects there. Because I travel a bit, I do have to schedule things. I know what I'm doing, certainly, until the end of February, almost. I know my geographical position, not necessarily what I'll be doing, but I have to plan geographically where I'll be for the next month or so, because I've got to book hotels, flights and meetings. If I have to find a free day for someone, finding free days is not easy anymore because I'm so busy. But I'm not busy doing structured stuff. I'm busy because I have to show up at various different places.
So looking back on your career, how have you evolved in your work style? And you've described that a little bit. Some people can say, oh, when I started my PhD, I kind of worked in this way, or I had these habits.
Yeah.
And when I finished, there was something about me that was different.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the best thing about doing a PhD is meeting the people. When I started my PhD, I'd come out of my degree. I was still young, very inexperienced. You know, I started my PhD when I was, I think I was 20 or 21. You know, I my PhD when I was 24. When I started my PhD, I was still working the mindset of, I've done my degree, I'm in a laboratory, I'll do this. By the end of my PhD, I knew how to do a PhD, so I'd almost wish that I could go back and start again. But I was quite lucky. I was kind of, my supervisor left after my first year, so I had to jump ship and take on another supervisor and change direction completely, so that was a bit of a learning experience. And then my boss said something one day that made quite a difference to me. So this is after I got my PhD, I'd worked for a couple of years in Cambridge, started in this research group in Glasgow, and I was responsible for one of the big pieces of kit. And we had the group meeting, and it's Colin Stanley, who's retired some years ago from Glasgow. He was in the electronics department. And he said, we're thinking about doing this set of experiments. Is this going to be possible? What do you think, Alistair? And I said, well, if it was up to me, I would do this. And he looked at me and he said, now, Alistair, it is up to you. It's yours now. And it made, and that was quite, it was, I don't think he realised what he'd said, but it made me realise that I'd made the transition from learning about research and doing it to guiding it. You know, I was still relatively young there, you know, sort of mid to late 20s. And I guess as time has gone on, I've just evolved from that. The thing about research is not to worry about it. If things go wrong, don't worry about it. In research, what you've got to do is keep at it. Because if you keep at it, something good comes out of it. Even if all the results are negative. Another great friend of mine, when something bad happens, he always used to say, if anything bad happens, it's an opportunity. So you've got to be the eternal optimist.
And you talked about how getting a PhD in physics, it taught you how to get a PhD.
Yes.
And so you've also talked a bit about how you've learned these different subject areas that you've learned a bit about biochemistry, or that maybe you're working on biochemistry right now.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, it sounds like you are doing that on your own. You don't take a class, or do you sit in on lectures ever?
When I was working in physics and semiconductors, that's pure physics. The interesting thing about nanomaterials is they can get into any subject area at all, environmental, energy. So that meant I started getting involved with people that were working on chemistry and nanomaterials. Catalysis is an obvious one. So that started getting me into chemistry. When you get into a different subject area, the laboratories are different, the mindset's different, the language is different, the science is different. So it's like learning a new language and a new culture. So I was quite astonished when I started working in a chemical lab to see how big the differences were and how different the language is. In my role in Inverness, I took that on last May, so it's early days yet. There's a group meeting once a week where students will give talks on their research in biochemistry. And quite honestly, I don't really know what they're talking about. But, you know, I'm a professor in medical nanotechnology, but I'm a physicist. I mean, one of the great things about physics is it gives you the armoury to get stuck into anything. That's why I love physics so much. What I'm learning now about biochemistry is, first, I've got to go back to year one at university when I was doing physics and say, oh gosh, I've got to learn all this stuff again. So I've got to learn the language of biochemistry, how it operates. But even at this early stage, I can see the work they're doing and I can see the problems they're having and I can see what I can do can help, and I don't know what it's going to do to help, but by working with them we'll find common nodes of interaction which are already popping up about how the work I'm doing can match in with the research that's already happening in Inverness. So that's really exciting because 5 years down the line, I've got no idea what research I'll be doing.
You don't take a formal course, but you listen in on student
I listen in on students and do a lot of reading. I mean, there's a good book, Biochemistry for Dummies, which I've just... You know, it's written by people that know biochemistry, but, you know, I don't know the words yet.
So that helps you to communicate with the people helps me to bridge this gap. What do you like most about working in science and technology? What do you most enjoy about
it? Oh, gosh. My wife would be testament to this. Essentially, I think about science all of the time. That's the world I live in. When I was walking to this meeting today, I was thinking about biochemistry and antimicrobials and experiments, and I just love it. It's just something that's taken over. It's not to say that I don't have outside interest. You know, obviously I've got my family. In between jobs, I worked as a chef for 3 months because I love cooking.
Yeah.
When I'm up in Scotland, if I ever get the chance, I'll have to go hill walking, which again just gives you a chance to open your mind and think about things. It's hard to pin down saying, what do I like about science? I just love science because I just love knowing how things work. You know, for me, the great thing about physics is that, you know, physics explains a lot of things, but it also explains why we don't know much about anything as well, which I think is fantastic. You know, all the new phenomena that are being discovered in quantum mechanics and new, you know, it's like quantum entanglement, are huge questions philosophically about how some of these things work, which is absolutely fantastic. And then there's this new area, you know, which Glasgow is big into, all the quantum technologies which are coming out. I find hugely fascinating about how that's going to change things. I've been involved in some of the new labs or existing labs that are working in quantum computing. I was lucky enough to be invited to IBM in Zurich about 18 months ago to meet with their scientists working on quantum computers. Absolutely astonished at the progress that they're making, that you can actually go to IBM's website and build a quantum algorithm, run it to see if it will run, and then you can dump it onto a real quantum computer. Things that are coming up in the future, like superconductors, what else is coming up? There's lots of fusion reactors is another really exciting one now. They were always 30 years in the future, but I think they're more like 20 years. All of a sudden, that time frame has begun to shrink a bit because of, well, that's enabled by, you know, new lasers that are coming out. I've got a colleague that runs a company in Arizona who makes the most powerful laser diodes in the world, and they're used to pump even bigger lasers that are used for fusion reactors. But all this new tech that's enabling this stuff is, you know, when we get fusion power in quantum computing, the world will never be the same again. If you get fusion power up and running, then, you know, you can, if you get the right kind of water, you can run the US on a, you know, a few bottles of water a day. So it means that you'll be able to make stuff for free, and that will change the world forever. So, and we're just on the cusp of this. So a few generations from now, you know, the world's going to be hopefully in a good place.
Hopefully, yeah.
Hopefully we'll have done something for the environment.
To sort of summarize, in terms of what you like most, to me what it sounds like is that you find it really engaging, that it's just these problems and that you kind of dig into them, and that the interconnectedness of it is something that it's almost like, I don't want to say you've fallen into a trap, but you've kind of fallen into something that you don't want to get out of, that you enjoy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I like the interdisciplinary part of it as well, because you can go into a chemistry lab or you can talk to a surgeon and you see what they're doing and you can go, why are you doing it that way? You know, I've done this in the past and it just comes from completely, you know, left field. And you can look at something and go, gosh, that's amazing. And you go, it's not amazing, it's dead simple, but it's ignorance. It's just, it's not you're being stupid, it's just you didn't know about it.
Yeah.
I love being able to do that.
you've talked a bit about the future and things that you find exciting for the future, but are there things that you personally are looking forward to? You said you don't know what research you're going to be doing in 5 years,
mm-hmm.
but I think you've got a general direction, I guess, that you're going in.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to developing in the interdisciplinary area. So it's going to be, I've talked about all these quantum technologies, so there will be quantum sensors that I can apply with my nanomaterials to biomedical problems, so that you'll have an implant that will have a quantum sensor in it, and you will have your medical synthetic twin in a hospital monitoring you and people, AI monitoring that person, so you'll have a virtual medical twin communicating by quantum entanglement, so that you can prevent things happening. But, and that will happen. It's not going to happen in the next few years. It'll happen in the next few generations. Yes, so I don't know what I will be doing, but I know there are some very exciting things happening. And I think just a few generations down the line, humans are going to be in a completely different place. It's very exciting. I can remember the first day I started my physics degree. It was Edward Eisner was the head of physics. And he walked into the lecture theatre and he said, I've got good news for you. You're starting a degree in physics. It's the most exciting ever time to start physics. But I think he said that every year to his students. But what I would say now is that in terms of physics and materials and technology, it is an absolutely fascinating time for technology. Anyone listening to this that wants to stick with physics, stick with it, because it means that you can apply yourself to anything.
That's great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.